I want you to do something for me right now. It doesn't matter where you are driving, cooking, sitting at a desk. Just stop for a second. Take a deep breath in, hold it, and blow it all the way out.
Feels simple enough.
It sounds simple, doesn't it? We do it, what, 20,000 times a day without even registering it? But here's the challenge. If I asked you to measure that breath, to capture the exact volume, the speed, the flow rate, and do it so accurately that a doctor could base a life-altering diagnosis on it, how confident would you be in that result?
It's a completely different challenge. You're moving from a biological reflex to a high-stakes physics problem.
Right.
It's the difference between blowing up a party balloon and performing a calibrated medical procedure.
And that is exactly what we are unpacking today. We are diving deep into the world of spirometry measuring lung function. But we're not just, skimming the surface here.
Mm-hmm.
We are looking at a very specific, very rigorous set of standards for what are called professional spirometry systems.
Mm-hmm.
Our mission for this deep dive is to figure out the massive gap between a gadget that just generates a pretty curve on a screen
mm-hmm.
and a professional system that provides what the experts call clinical defensibility.
And that phrase, that phrase is the anchor for everything we're going to talk about, clinical defensibility.
It sounds incredibly legal, like something you say in a courtroom, not a doctor's office.
In a way, it is, because when you strip away all the marketing, the shiny plastic casing, and the Bluetooth features, the core question is just, can we trust this data?
Yeah.
If you diagnose someone with COPD or asthma based on this machine's numbers, you are putting them on a treatment path that could last the rest of their life. If the machine is wrong, the diagnosis is wrong.
That's the part that surprised me going through the source material. I always assumed, sensor is a sensor. You blow into a tube, a little fan spins or something, and you get a number. But the text makes it so clear that capturing air is, it seems surprisingly chaotic.
Oh, it's incredibly chaotic. Think about what you just did. You blew air out. That air is invisible, it's compressible, it's turbulent, and this is the gross part, it is warm and wet.
Oh, right.
Trying to measure that dynamic, messy substance with absolute precision repeatedly over years, that is a massive engineering hurdle.
Okay, so let's get into the nuts and bolts of this.
Mm-hmm.
The source material draws this hard line between accuracy in a perfect world, like a lab, and accuracy in real life.
Yeah.
What's the core philosophy there?
The philosophy of a professional system is that it has to be cynical. It has to assume things will go wrong. The source text puts it really well. Systems that only work well under ideal conditions fail real clinical workflows.
But let me play devil's advocate for a second.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm the patient, shouldn't I just be taught to do it right? If I hold the device wrong, isn't that my fault, not the machine's?
In a perfect world, maybe. But clinical spirometry happens in the real world. You might be testing a six-year-old with asthma who's scared. You might be testing an elderly patient who doesn't quite understand the instructions.
Or the room is just humid.
Or the room is humid because the AC broke. A professional system is designed to handle all that noise, the bad technique, the environment, and still filter out a signal that reflects the actual lung function.
So clinical defensibility basically means the data holds up even when the situation is a mess.
Precisely. It means the result is an outcome of system-wide reliability, not just a lucky guess on a good day.
Let's talk about the hardware then, because you can have the best philosophy in the world, but if the sensor, the actual thing the air hits, is cheap, the data is going to be cheap. The text talks about consistent signal fidelity. What does that actually look like?
It really comes down to what they call the range challenge. And this is where most, consumer-grade devices just fall apart. The human breath is a massive spectrum.
Okay.
On one end, imagine a rower or a swimmer, someone with huge lung capacity blowing with hurricane force. On the other end, you have a pediatric patient or someone with severe emphysema who can barely move any air at all.
And the machine has to catch both.
It has to measure both with the exact same level of precision. And that is incredibly difficult. If you build a sensor that's sensitive enough to catch the whisper of a breath from a sick child,
a strong adult will blow right past its limit.
Exactly. They'll blow right past its limit.
The text called that saturation, right?
Yes. Think of it like a speedometer in a car that only goes up to 100. If you drive 120, the needle is just pinned. The data is lost.
Mm.
You've saturated the sensor. You don't know if the patient blew 100 or 150, and medically that difference is huge.
But I assume the low end is easier. If the flow is slow, The machine has plenty of time to read it.
Actually, the low end is much, much harder. This is the signal-to-noise ratio problem.
Break that down for me.
Okay, imagine you're trying to listen to a very quiet piece of classical music on the radio, but there's static in the background. If the patient's breath is too quiet, you can't tell the difference between the cello and the static. In a spirometer, the device itself has electrical noise. A professional sensor has to be incredibly refined to distinguish that faint airflow from the background buzz of its own electronics.
So it has to be linear. It can't just be accurate in the middle average zone.
That's the key. Linearity across the entire curve. And we haven't even touched on the physical abuse the sensor takes. Remember what I said about breath being warm and wet?
Yeah, you called it gross.
It is. When warm breath hits a room temperature sensor, you get condensation immediately. Water droplets form on the measuring mechanism. If you're using a cheap turbine or a delicate wire, that water adds weight. It creates drag.
And that just changes the numbers.
Drastically. It causes drift. If you test 5 patients in a row, the 5th measurement might be off by 10% just because the sensor is damp. Professional sensors are designed to resist that. They have to remain stable over thousands of wet, forceful blows without drifting.
Okay, that brings us to the concept of truth. We've got a sensor that handles the hurricane and the whisper. But how do we know the number on the screen matches reality? This is the whole calibration section.
The source material refers to this as calibration stability. It's the handshake between the airflow and the digital readout.
I'll be honest, when I read about calibration syringes, daily checks, it sounded like a massive hassle. Do clinics really do this every day? It feels like something you'd skip if you were busy.
And that is the danger zone. You're right, it is a hassle. But the text argues that the method, whether it's manual or automated, matters less than the verification. The enemy here is silent calibration failure.
That sounds like a horror movie title.
It's the worst case scenario in diagnostics. Imagine your bathroom scale is off by 10 pounds, but it still shows you a number every morning. You think you're maintaining your weight, but you're actually gaining.
Oh, wow.
In a clinic, if the machine drifts and doesn't tell you, you are treating a patient based on fiction.
So a professional system needs to scream at you if it's wrong.
It needs to be undeniable. The user must know the calibration status instantly before they even start a test. There's just no room for, I think it's okay.
Now, this next part was my biggest aha moment of the research, the software. Specifically, this no smoothing rule.
This is critical, and it runs completely counter to everything we're used to in modern tech.
Right, because usually we love smoothing. We want our phone screens to scroll smoothly. We want our photos to look clean. When I see a graph with a jagged, ugly line, my instinct is bad design. I want the computer to fix it.
In graphic design, yes. In medicine, that fix is a lie.
A lie.
A dangerous lie. Think about what a jagged line on a spirometry graph actually represents. It's not just pixelated graphics. A sudden notch in the curve might be a cough. It might be the patient's throat closing up for a millisecond glottic closure.
Or their lip slipping.
Or a leak where their lip slipped off the mouthpiece. It's evidence of what happened during the test.
It is the fingerprint of the pathology.
It is. And if the software uses an algorithm to smooth that curve, to make it look like a perfect textbook breath, it is masking the disease.
That's a really scary thought. It's like using a beauty filter on an X-ray because the broken bone looked messy.
That is the perfect analogy. You don't want a pretty X-ray. You want to see the fracture. Professional software preserves the waveform detail. It refuses to tidy up. In fact, it should flag those ugly parts.
Right.
It should tell the operator, hey, look at this jagged bit here. This wasn't a good test, rather than auto-correcting it to look normal.
That connects directly to the human being running the machine, the nurse, the technician. The text talks about usability, but not in the way I expected. I usually think of usability as, is it annoying to use? But the text frames it as an accuracy issue.
It's about cognitive load. I mean, think about a nurse in a busy clinic. They're 20 minutes behind schedule, the waiting room is full, and they haven't had lunch. If the spirometer interface is confusing, if they have to dig through 5 submenus just to start a test, what happens?
They get frustrated. They rush.
They get tired. And when humans are cognitively overloaded, we take shortcuts. We miss details. A professional interface is designed to reduce that friction so the operator can focus on the patient, not on the computer.
And the patient needs that focus, right? This isn't like taking a blood pressure reading where you just sit there.
Not at all. Spirometry is an athletic event. The patient has to perform. The nurse has to be a coach. They are yelling, blow, 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 keep going.
Keep pushing, yeah.
And real-time visual feedback on the screen is crucial. It helps the nurse see if the patient is slacking off during the test so they can correct them instantly.
Don't stop yet, push it out.
Exactly. That feedback loop is part of the system's accuracy. If the screen is lagging or unclear, the coaching fails and the data is garbage.
While we're on the subject of yelling blow and forcing air out of lungs, we have to talk about the elephant in the room, or rather the microbes in the room.
Infection control, yes.
Yeah. I mean, post-2020, the idea of a machine designed to capture forceful exhalation from sick people just sounds like a biohazard.
It is a biohazard. Spirometry generates aerosols. By definition, you are asking a sick person to cough and spray into a device.
So how does a professional system handle that differently than a cheap one? You can't just wipe it down.
Oh, can't just use a wet nap. We're talking about hospital-grade disinfectants, harsh chemicals. This is where materials science comes in. If you use cheap plastics, those chemicals will eventually cause micro cracks in the housing.
And cracks are bad.
Cracks are hiding spots. Bacteria and viruses can live in those microscopic fissures, protected from the next round of cleaning. A professional system is designed with materials that tolerate repeated chemical exposure without degrading. And the geometry matters. Two smooth surfaces. No weird crevices where germs can hide.
It really is a battle on all fronts. You're fighting physics, human error, and biology. But I want to zoom out to the biggest picture, the long game. The text mentions longitudinal reliability.
This is where we move from diagnosing a single illness to managing a human life. Chronic lung diseases like COPD don't go away. You monitor them for 10, 20 years.
So if I get tested today and then again in 5 years, the comparison matters.
It is the only thing that matters. If the number drops by 10% over 5 years, we need to be 100% sure that your lungs have gotten 10% worse.
And not that the sensor has just degraded by 10%.
Correct. If the machine drifts over time, that 10% drop might be a ghost. Repeatability over long periods is the hallmark of professional gear. And this links to one of the most technical but fascinating points in the text, data storage. Specifically, storing the raw data versus just saving the report.
I questioned this one. I thought, why do we need all the raw data points? It takes up space. Why not just save the PDF with the results and move on?
Because medical science isn't static. It changes. The reference equations, the math we use to predict what's normal for a 40-year-old male, get updated. We might get a new global standard in 2028.
Oh, I see where this is going.
If you only saved the PDF report from 2026, you are stuck with the old math. That data is frozen in time. But if the system saved the raw data, the actual flow and volume points, the raw signal, you can reload that test 10 years later and apply the new 2028 math to it.
It's like time travel for medical records. You can upgrade the past.
It's future-proofing. It ensures that a patient's history doesn't become obsolete just because the standards change.
That leads nicely into the ecosystem idea. The text talks about scalability and suppliers. It specifically spotlights a company called BoMyMed. Now, usually when I see a company name, I tune out, but the text treats them almost like a case study. Why?
They're used as an example of what this professional checklist looks like in practice. It's about the difference between buying a device and adopting a platform.
What's the distinction?
A device is a one-off purchase. You buy a handheld spirometer, throw it in a drawer, and hope it works. The text highlights BoMyMed because their approach and the approach of any optimal supplier is cohesive. They prioritize defensible data over just piling on features.
So they aren't selling the one with the MP3 player, the color touchscreen, if the sensor is trash.
Right. And it's about scalability. A small clinic might start with one device, but if they grow into a hospital network, they need equipment that scales with them. Standardized consumables, standardized software, standardized support.
That procurement friction term came up.
It's a real headache for hospitals. If you have 5 different devices from 5 different years, you need 5 different types of filters, 5 different calibration syringes. It's a logistical nightmare. The optimal supplier creates a standardized ecosystem. It's boring stuff, supply chains, and standardization. But that is what keeps a hospital running smoothly.
It seems like their approach is very much about acknowledging that the clinic is a messy, high-pressure environment and the equipment needs to be the anchor in that storm.
That's the perfect way to put it. The equipment cannot be another variable. It has to be the constant.
So let's bring this all back home. We started with the simple breath. We've gone through sensors, software, hygiene, data architecture. If you had to summarize the final checklist for our listener, how do we wrap this up?
I would ask you to imagine the patient journey. It starts with repeatable accuracy. When that patient blows into the tube, does the machine give the same number every time, regardless of whether the nurse is rushing or the room is hot?
Okay.
Then it's resilience. Can the machine handle the coughs, the weak breaths, and the struggle without crashing or saturating? Next is data integrity. Is the machine telling you the ugly truth, or is it smoothing over the cracks? And finally, workflow. Does the system help the care team focus on the human being in the chair?
If it misses even one of those, that might be a cool gadget, but it's not a professional system.
It might be a fine screening tool for a gym, but it's not clinically defensible. It shouldn't be used to decide someone's medical future.
It really changes how you look at a medical chart. You see a number, FEV1, 80%. And now you realize there's an army of engineering and protocol standing behind that number to make sure it's real.
And that leads me to a final thought for everyone listening. We live in a quantified world. We have watches that measure our oxygen, rings that track our sleep, apps that count our steps. We are drowning in data.
We really are. I check my sleep score every morning.
But we often confuse measurement with truth. Just because a device gives you a number to two decimal places doesn't mean it reflects reality. A number on a screen is meaningless unless the system producing it is designed to fight against the chaos of the real world. When it comes to your health, you don't just want a measurement, you want the truth.
You don't just want a measurement, you want the truth.
Mm-hmm.
That is a powerful place to leave it. Next time you take a deep breath at the doctor's office, you'll know exactly what's going on inside that little machine and why it matters so much. Thanks for taking this deep dive with us.
Thank you.
We'll catch you next time.